welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Churchill's Man of Mystery, Desmond Morton and the World of Intelligence, with the author Jill Bennett. This is Churchill's personal assistant, a very secretive chap, in the run-up to World War II and right the way through the war. Plus our weekly news update with Jason Yannakopoulos and the weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch Helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753. I want to have a reminder of the phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. But to start, Churchill's Man of Mystery and Jill Bennett, the author of the book, is joining me on the line now. Could you introduce yourself and tell us why you chose Desmond Morton to write a book about?
Okay, well, my name's Jill Bennett. I was the chief historian at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office between 1995 and 2005. And when I worked there, I kept coming across Desmond Morton in all sorts of different contexts. And I became very interested in him, and so I tried to investigate a little more, and I was lucky enough to be given permission to go through the secret archives in order to find out about him.
Tell us about those secret archives.
Well, I mean, as you know, the archives of the Secret Intelligence Service, otherwise known as MI6, are not open to the public, and they are not released into the public domain. So the only way you can see them is if you are appointed as an official historian, which I was. And that meant I could have access to the records about Desmond Morton in the SIS archives.
Now, tell us a little bit about his childhood and his early life.
Well, he was unfortunately, he's such a secret person that it's very difficult to find out about his personal life. But he was an only child, late Victorian upbringing, went to Eton, then went to Woolwich to the military academy, and he just come out of that when the First World War started, and he went straight to the Western Front from Woolwich.
So how did he get on there?
Well, he had a very hard war. He was in the Royal Field Artillery. He commanded a battery of guns, and they were the people who really were on the front line all the time. But in 1917, he suffered a severe wound. He was shot, and a bullet lodged near his heart, where it remained until he died at the age of 80. So he was invalided home, but then went back in order to serve as the aide-de-camp to Field Marshal Haig.
Now, let's just go back slightly. You're saying that you kept coming across him. What was it that piqued your interest then about Desmond Morton? Because obviously, you know, as an archivist and a historian, you're going to come across lots of people to do with the Second World War. Why Desmond?
Well, because he kept coming up in different contexts. In the late 90s, I was involved in a big investigation commissioned by the then Foreign Secretary, Robin Cook, of the Zinoviev letter, which was a letter that had supposed to have been sent by the Comintern to the British Communist Party in 1924. And Morton's footprints were all over that story. Later on, I was working on those issues that used to be called Nazi gold, about the gold that was confiscated from governments and individuals during the Second World War, and I found that he was the British commissioner on the Tripartite Gold Commission. And he turned up in various other places, and I thought there must be something about him, and I got interested in him.
I think you're absolutely right. There was, because between the wars, he met Winston Churchill, didn't he? Can you tell us how that happened and what transpired?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that one.
Okay, that's okay. I know between the wars, Desmond met Winston Churchill. How did he meet him? And
met Churchill on the Western Front in the First World War, when Churchill briefly served out there in 1916. And the two of them met on the battlefield at a place called Ploegsteert, and they became friends. And they remained friends and saw one another occasionally. In the 20s, Morton bought a house in Kent near Chartwell, where Churchill's house was. And because they were both interested in armament, British rearmament, and British economic preparations for war, they spent a lot of time together. Consequently, later on, when Churchill became Prime Minister in May 1940, he asked Morton to become his intelligence advisor, and Morton went to work with him in Number 10.
Well, that's interesting that they lived close to each other near Chartwell in Kent. I mean, it makes you wonder whether there were clandestine meetings down there, that maybe Churchill walked the mile or so, mile and a half over to see Morton and the other way round.
I think it's more likely to be the other way round. Churchill was not a great one for walking. We know that Morton used to walk over the hill. In fact, I've travelled that route when I was doing the book to see it's not very far. There are a lot of stories about how Morton supplied secret information to Churchill, but I really don't think that this is true. Government ministers themselves supplied Churchill with information even when he was not in the government. Churchill, after all, had been a cabinet minister on a number of occasions. He was very well plugged in to the political establishment. In fact, Churchill himself had a very wide set of intelligence connections, where he collected intelligence, and quite a lot of it he passed on to Morton. So I'm afraid that the nice story about Morton passing him secret information around the back door is not a true one. But on the other hand, both of them had access to secret reports on, for example, German rearmament.
Well, that's right, because in the interwar years, Churchill wrote a very influential book, didn't he, called The Gathering Storm?
Yeah, well, of course, he wrote it later. But, I mean, Churchill, of course, is known for having attacked the government during the 1930s, urging it to rearm more quickly. But you have to remember that it's all very well for people who are in opposition to say that such and such a thing should happen and that money should be spent in a certain way. Churchill believed it was his duty to ginger up the government and try and make them rearm more quickly, but he was also well aware of the constraints that government ministers have in that regard. So Churchill could undoubtedly cause quite a lot of trouble for the government, but they all knew him well, and it was by no means quite so cut and dried as a lot of books make out.
So what was Morton's job at MI6?
Morton, after the First World War, in 1919, he left Hague and he went to work in what it was then called Section MI1C, but it was the Secret Intelligence Service. And he had a job called Head of Production, which meant essentially he was responsible for getting hold of information, overseas intelligence, particularly on Soviet Russia, finding out having officers posted all over different territories who were passing that information, which he collated and passed on to whoever needed to see them. So it was a very central position.
And what about into the Second World War? Because obviously Churchill had been quite sidelined in the run-up to World War II, but as soon as it became clear that Nazi Germany was on a campaign to take over countries, Churchill's star rose very rapidly. What was Morton doing at this time?
It did. I mean, after Chamberlain became Prime Minister in 1937, I mean, by that time things were definitely getting very difficult, and everybody was aware that there was likely to be a war. But Churchill was by no means popular in the Conservative Party, so it took a long time before anybody was willing to embrace the idea of having him in the government. But then after the first 9 months of the war, and then there was the attack on the Low Countries, basically Chamberlain went, as Chamberlain stepped down, and Churchill became Prime Minister, and really he came into his own then. He was a man who flourished in wartime.
What do we know about Desmond Morton's other associates at the time, particularly during and at the beginning of the Second World War?
Well, I mean, he was the Prime Minister's eyes and ears in liaison with the intelligence agencies initially in the Second World War. Later on, Churchill formed his own closer relationships with the heads of the various agencies, and Morton didn't have quite so much to do. But certainly in 1940 and for a couple of years thereafter, Morton spent his time on Churchill's behalf, gathering information and telling the intelligence agencies what Churchill wanted, and basically putting a bomb under them, not literally, of course, whenever he felt it was necessary. It was a kind of position of power that Morton very much enjoyed, but it wasn't a proper job, if you like. He was an advisor. He didn't have a ministry or civil service job.
What about his personal private life? Did he ever get married, have children?
No, he never married, and I never found any reference to him having any close relationship with either man or woman. He was one, though. I mean, there were quite a lot of men like Morton who had been in the First World War and had a really very bad experience, which marked them forever. And there was a whole generation, in some ways, of, if you like, rather careful bachelors who enjoyed mixing with their fellow men, but they didn't marry and they didn't form close relationships. And I do think that the First World War had a lot to do with that. I never found anything more about his private life.
Now, you mentioned that he was looking into Soviet Russia. I mean, of course, during World War II, we were allies with Soviet Russia. What was Morton's approach to that? Because he seemed to have spent quite a lot of his time, really, I suppose, seeing them as the enemy.
Well, that's right. And, of course, he wasn't the only one. I mean, it was the alliance with the Soviet Union was, of course, a matter of high politics and a matter of strategy. And Britain was not always good bedfellows with the Soviet Union. However, Morton, like any government servant, did what he had to do. But it's clear from letters he wrote later that he found aspects of the Soviet regime very distasteful. Morton was a very religious man. He was a devout Roman Catholic. And, of course, Soviet communism was definitely an atheistic doctrine, which he didn't approve of, quite apart from anything else.
What happened at the end of the war, then? Did Morton still retain some of his anti-Soviet capabilities? Because many people, of course, did.
I think he did, though I wouldn't. It didn't really apply to his professional life. After the Second World War ended, he did several jobs. He sat on the Reparations Commission, as the British Reparations Commission. That was to do with getting countries recovering war from Nazi Germany and so on. He didn't really have to have an awful lot to do with the Soviet Union, but letters that he wrote shows that he had no illusions about the way the Soviet Union was going.
Now, I was at Chartwell this summer and walking through Churchill's study down near Westerham in Kent.
Yes.
And spoke to one of the guides for the National Trust down there and asked them about Churchill and his Freemasonry. And I was immediately denied. He said, no, Churchill was never a Freemason. And I said to the guide, wasn't Churchill a Freemason? He said, no, he was never a Freemason. Well, of course, then I brought up on my smartphone a Daily Mail article which explained that Churchill's Masonic desk equipment, bits and pieces, were being sold at auction. So, of course, he was a Freemason. And many people point to this as a sort of negative influence because the Yalta Agreement, all three of them were Freemasons, him and Roosevelt and Stalin, for example. Winston Churchill's writing case, Masonic writing case, with his Masonic equipment in it, including a portable leather satchel and various other things, was sold at auction in May 2008. There is evidence that, if you want it there, that Churchill was a Freemason. What about Morton?
Well, I mean, I know what's said about Churchill, and I mean, obviously, if there was some equipment, there's some equipment, but from all the documentation that I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot, I've never seen any evidence that Churchill actually was a Freemason, nor do I believe that Morton was, although during the 1920s, when he was involved with various circles of British businessmen that he was trying to get information out of, he, if you like, played the role of a Mason in order to get information from them. If they were Masons, they was extremely secret, because I've never seen anything to indicate that.
What about this business with the Nazi Gold Commission? Because this was obviously a very important job Morton had right at the end of the war.
Yes. Well, I mean, what happened was at the end of the war, a tripartite gold commission, that was Americans, the French and the British, was set up in order, initially, it was to try and get back some of the gold, because countries like Belgium, the whole of their central bank had been taken over by the Nazis and they lost everything. So it was trying to find and retrieve some of the gold that belonged to these countries and give it back so that they could try to get back some sort of economic life after the war. There was obviously, there was also a question of gold that had been taken from individuals and property that had been either hidden or destroyed, or indeed had been laundered by supposedly neutral countries during the war. Now, although quite a lot was known about this, the whole truth really only started to come out in the late 1990s, when there was a lot of stories that came out about dormant bank accounts in Swiss banks and so on, in which some of this property was hidden. But in the 40s, the commission had just started work, and Morton was the British commissioner for a while. In fact, it was quite a bureaucratic job, and the real excitement of the commission didn't happen until many years later.
What was the Swiss role? Because, I mean, one does wonder, doesn't it, where you've got Switzerland there with these big mountains, and the Swiss kind
Sorry,
of...
Sorry, I couldn't hear that.
The Swiss kind of looking down on Europe and seeing the First World War raging, the Second World War raging around them. I mean, one can be a bit cynical and say, well, they've made a lot of money out of both wars.
Well, of course, the neutral countries are obviously attractive during wartime for other countries to try and launder their money through, and Switzerland was no exception. And Switzerland, of course, has a long tradition of banking and of banking secrecy, but other countries were involved in too. I mean, Spain and Portugal and Sweden, and so it was all ways of Germany in particular trying to use other people's gold in order to pay for raw materials. And because there were blockades and there were the Allies had measures in place to stop the Germans from moving around money freely, then clearly the Germans tried to use neutral countries in order to do that, and the Allies tried to stop them.
Finally, what picture can you paint of Morton and Churchill? Because one of the claims that Morton made was that he moved down to Crockham Hill, just close to Churchill's home, before Churchill bought Chartwell. And so he was implying that, in a way, that Churchill...
It was roughly around the same time. I think they must have both been looking in the area. And in fact, you're quite right. Morton actually paid up for his house before Churchill actually moved in. But of course, the purchase of Chartwell did take some time. So I don't know the detail, but I can presume that Morton looked in that area because he knew that Churchill was looking in that area too.
That was Jill Bennett there, and she's the author of Churchill's Man of Mystery, Desmond Morton and the World of Intelligence. A very interesting figure at the end and actually in the run-up to the Second World War, who definitely was one of those people that tried everything they could to stay in the shadows. Churchill's Man of Mystery, Desmond Morton and the World of Intelligence is a book by Jill Bennett, published by Routledge in 2009. And in case anyone's interested in the idea of Churchill and the Freemasons, the Daily Mail article published on the 2nd of May 2008 is entitled Winston Churchill's Freemasons Writing Case Will Be Sold at Auction. And it does actually name Winston Churchill's Masonic Lodge. The tan exterior is stamped in gilt with the words Brother Winston L.S. Churchill, Studholme Lodge, number 1591.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
How many people living together does it take to make a fully self-sustaining modern community? Where there are enough specialists to deliver modern civilised needs and comforts such as health, education, water and power, transport and agriculture? And could such a community be entirely self-sustaining? Not making everything itself, but having surpluses they could use to trade and barter with the outside world for what they couldn't make themselves? Well, those are the questions that gripped two people with Bristol connections, both of whom found themselves over at the Centre for Alternative Technology at McCuncliffe in Wales back in the early 1990s. One was the director of the Schumacher Society, Richard St. George, who sadly died last year. So, as a tribute to Richard and to his work, here's his colleague, former director of Solon Southwest Housing Association and of the Centre for Alternative Technology itself, Roger Kelly. He describes their plan, which ended up being called Ecoville 2000, because it looked like they would only be able to build this state-of-the-art eco-village community in France. So here's Roger talking about Richard and his Ecoville 2000 at the Somerset Big Green Gathering back in the summer of 2007. Apologies for the sound quality.
Yeah, okay, so and then the third element of the economy of this village, as you can probably imagine, is eco-tourism. I mean, it's perfectly placed for that. So we included in our feasibility study a development of what we called an eco-gite. Now, again, now, I mean, there are thousands of gites that people market as being as green gites in one way or another, but they weren't at that time. And I think it could have been quite a profitable enterprise. So, yeah, I mean, I think that is basically the story. I mean, I've told you about how we went about the feasibility study and it all fell apart at the end because the guy didn't want to sell his land. And I've told you a little bit about, you know, how we actually went about doing this feasibility study. I think this was Gerard's idea. He had tried it over here in a few places and got absolutely nowhere. So his feeling was that it had to be done first of all somewhere else in Europe and that eventually it would find its way back here. Now, a few years ago, I know he was in negotiation with Harris County Council to set up something similar there. And there was Paris. It was actually in a stone quarry. not a slate quarry this time, but I'm not sure what stone it was, actually. I'm not sure why that didn't develop, actually. Because I think in that instance, the Paris Planning Department were actually quite supportive. So there must have been other reasons why. But I mean, obviously, one of the big issues over here is land values. I mean, almost any other country in Europe, apart from the Netherlands, possibly. It was partly because of the difference in planning laws and partly in the difference in the government attitude towards different forms of housing provision in France that made it so much easier for us there. We'd had this funding to produce the feasibility study and that had come to an end and basically I had to go and earn a living. So, which is why I passed all the material on to other people who were actively looking for land to develop eco-village ideas. Oh, sure, it's a hell of a lot easier to start something going with a smaller group of people. And certainly in our trying to disentangle the process by which a development of this size could happen, we recognised that there had to be a core of people who were fully committed to it in the first place and who might possibly later on withdraw from it altogether, but had the vision and the commitment to get the thing moving in the first place and to act as stewards for the ideals that had to be put into place. If you look at existing villages anywhere in the world, basically, and they have grown up organically as a result, almost always, of certain economic considerations to do with the land and how people can make a living out of the land, and that brings people together in one place, and then they need other skills that bring other people in, and so on. Whereas now, everything is planned top-down. So any kind of new housing development, any kind of new town, has nothing actually to do with the land or what the land suggests to you. It's simply a matter of saying, we need X number of housing units, and, oh, yes, if we're going to have X number of people here, we'd better build a school, we'd better build some industrial units, and so on. And the really interesting question is there any way of finding something in between those two that allows communities to develop organically, but at a reasonable pace, so it's not 1,000 years before it reaches its fruition? We did a sort of fairly good analysis of the global eco-villages movement as part of the feasibility study. Yeah, and Crystal Waters is one of the ones in the farm in Tennessee. Those are examples. I mean, the farm in Tennessee had a population of 1,000 at one point. It's declined down to a few hundred now. But that's the other interesting. It seems to be something that affects eco-communities of all shapes and sizes. And a few years ago, I went to the European Eco-Villages Network meeting in Italy, and we did a tour around a number of eco-villages there. Some of them were newly starting eco-villages, and they were fantastic farmers. Loads of people there with fantastic energy, and they were building houses and doing things all over the place. And we went to some other communities that had been there for 20, 30 years, and they were fantastic places. I mean, you felt they were just sort of a dream. You would just love to go and live there. But all the young people had moved out of them. The age of the population was going up and up and up, and they were just dying on their feet. I don't know how many of you know Machynlleth and the surrounding area there. You know, I mean, that's a fairly remote rural area, but there are an awful lot of grain-based businesses around there. There are a lot of people that have consciously decided they want to go live there and do intellect-based activity. I do think, though, in the end, it's always going to be a very small minority. There are two aspects to it. One was the business of agriculture. So it was looking at the land and saying, okay, let's forget about, in a sense, the fact that there's an eco-community here. Just analyse the land and determine what the value that can be got out of it is and what the employment is. When we were designing the housing developments, each housing development had its own horticultural area attached to it. So the assumption was that each housing development will be self-sustaining in terms of at least a fruit and veg. The variety of housing tenure is important. There are examples of eco-communities that have been built in various places in the UK, but they go through this inevitable cycle. People either self-build or get built for them a house, which initially they manage to build quite economically. You know, the land values are fairly low and they do a lot of the work themselves and so on. They make it into something beautiful, and then of course they decide they want to move on, so they put it on the market, and suddenly it's valued at over £1 million. And only the other thing that came out to me most strongly from our investigation of other eco-villages was the weakness of the economic side of the sustainability triangle. In other words, you know, the triangle is environment, society and economy. And generally speaking, everybody involved in eco-villages pays a lot of attention to the environmental and social aspects of it. But because we all grew up, and I count myself among this, thinking economics is a dirty word and we shouldn't really bother about money, I think that's been one of the great downfalls. So I think it's, if something like this was to develop, it would be really important that there's the economic analysis of how it's going to function is given as much importance as the other aspects of it. One of the basic principles of an eco-village is that it has to live as far as possible within the limits of the resources. And that will determine to some extent the size of it. In a way, it just comes back to the same argument, what is the optimum size? If you've got an expanding business in an eco-village that clearly hasn't reached its optimal size, then that's great. If you've got an expanding business in one that has reached its optimal size, then the issue really is, do you expand physically, do you buy up the neighbouring land, or do you spin off another similar development, maybe 5 miles away, 10 miles away, or whatever? in this kind of field, we tend to think small all the time. Have any of you ever really sat down and thought about what would an eco-city of a million people be like? We don't really think about that. But why not? I mean, the Chinese actually are doing it. Yes. I think they've got about four. I mean, obviously, you have to go into the detail of it and determine whether it can be genuinely called an eco-city, but they have set out to build what they consider to be three or four eco-cities with population of a million plus. Yes.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Roger.
That was former director of the Centre for Alternative Technology in Wales there, Roger Kelly, talking about plans put together back in the early 1990s with Richard St George for a giant, self-sustaining eco-village. Apologies for the sound quality. And this broadcast is a tribute to Richard, the director of Bristol's Create Centre-based Schumacher Society, who sadly died last year.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Time to have a chat with Jason Yiannakopoulos. Hi, Jason. Hello, welcome
Tony.
To Dialect again. Well, what's in the news this week?
Tax avoidance or the shadow tax system. This is a wonderful thing. Private Eye have teamed up with the BBC Panorama Group to do a bit on tax avoidance. It's quite interesting, actually.
Okay, this is good old Private Eye. I love these little slots we do every once in a while. It comes out every 2 weeks, Private Eye. Bit of a limited hangout in my... Because, I've tried to get stories into Private Eye in the past. One of them was to do with an Israeli company which was in charge of the London Underground for the 6 months up to the London bombings, which was a company owned by its parent company. The chief executive was on the run in Namibia, having absconded with $13 million. Private Eye weren't interested in that particular story because they're quite actually pro-Israeli on the quiet. But anyway, what has Private Eye come up with on the way of tax avoidance? And interesting to see them doing a collaboration with Panorama.
Yes, it is quite interesting. It's showing that Britain really operates two different tax systems, sort of like a secret one for the millionaires and billionaires, and then the normal one for us.
That's an elite system, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's like a kind of banana republic where it's them and us, and if you're part of the club, you don't pay any tax. Everyone else gets hammered by Her Majesty's Revenue
pretty
and Customs.
Pretty much. I mean, it starts talking about the coalition government brought in, which was GAR, General Anti-Avoidance Rule. But it points out that Osborne's junior, David Gawk, launched the corporate tax roadmap with unmentioned destinations for land of vast tax dodging opportunity. The thing with the corporate tax roadmap was that tax breaks were found in the small print of the legislation, which meant there was no chance that the tax schemes emerging would be caught by any anti-tax avoidance law. Over the following couple of years, a series of committees compromising of notorious tax avoiders such as Vodafone, Tesco and HSBC, they looked at how the laws could be overhauled. Now, these were originally laws that were introduced by Nigel Lawson in 1984.
He was a Conservative Chancellor, I seem to remember.
Yes, he was Chancellor Exchequer during the Thatcher era. He sort of relaxed exchange controls, ensuring money flows better between British multinationals and tax saving subsidies.
Well, that also means, of course, that companies, the wealth in Britain, might then just go and invest abroad in places where they can make more money. So, for example, there are no laws protecting workers in Indonesia, for example, and so the British money can go out of Britain into Indonesia, invest in Indonesian slave labour type factories and make more money.
Yeah,
so that was the result of exchange controls being lifted.
Well, indeed. It says, moving profits this way was straightforward. UK-based multinationals simply put money into a tax haven subsidiary company in return for a share of the capital. For example, Vodafone, they made a Luxembourg finance company, and that lent money to the German arm of Vodafone, which is Mannesmann, and in turn, that paid billions of pounds of interest into the company in Luxembourg.
Well, that also means that they can decide where they want to pay their tax, where the tax rates are lowest. A bit cheeky.
Indeed. From 2015, Vodafone and Luxembourg taxed between nothing and a quarter of the main corporation tax, which from 2015 means a maximum of 5%. Now, we know from this that this is not... Now, we know from this the investigation that's done here that this is not just... dodging tax in foreign countries, but also dodging tax in the UK as well.
And how do you know that, Jason?
It's pretty much been stated by some members of KPMG and other tax firms. They actually spoke to Robert Edwards, who had been seconded to the Treasury to manage the process and make offshore taxes from 2010 to 2012. He confirms a simple UK tax saving technique: a British multinational could borrow money here and then place it in a tax saving company that would lend it to business elsewhere in the world. The borrowing costs would be reduced and the company's tax bill not just in the overseas location but also in the UK.
Well, so if you want to know why there's no investment in this country, this sounds like a pretty good reason why, Jason, because it's much more cost effective, or you get better rates of return if you're taking your money abroad and doing things over there. Another aspect to all of this, I must chip in again, is that David Cameron's family appear to have rather large amounts of money tied up in offshore tax havens themselves. His father, Ian Cameron, built up the family fortune using a network of investment funds in tax havens. Ian Cameron ran funds in Panama and Geneva, according to many of the mainstream papers, including the Daily Mail. David Cameron's family could have money tied up in offshore tax havens after it was revealed his father made a fortune through a network of offshore investment funds. The Guardian newspaper reports that Ian Cameron, who died in 2010, left a fortune of $2.74 million, from which the Prime Minister personally received a sum of £300,000 himself. His wealth of his father was estimated at £10 million. He ran several perfectly legal offshore accounts in tax havens such as Panama City and Geneva. So
that's shocking. I mean, it says here that the advice given to the BBC and the Private Eye by KPMG tax director Kashif Javed said that by making sure that board meetings do happen, that by... the only stumbling block to this is the fact you have to hold some board meetings abroad in your tax haven country, but he says all that means is you have to get the paperwork right. By making sure the board meetings do happen and you haven't got any emails flying around which demonstrate that the decisions are actually made in the UK, you can avoid any interest from the
Hang on, what are you saying? So that you could have people at a sort of virtual board meeting that's being done as a kind of conference call, but so long as the conference call itself is being run from the Canary Islands or Jersey, that decision is considered to be made over in Jersey, even though the people who are making it are all in England.
Yeah, I mean, David Byrne, the UK International Tax Services leader, says it's very that if you want to set up a finance company in somewhere like Luxembourg, it's very light. You don't technically need any employees. You go there and have board meetings maybe twice a year.
Well, I mean, it sounds to me. I mean, all that stuff. I wonder what with the information about Ian Cameron, David Cameron's father, having made his family fortune through these tax avoidance plans, whether actually what we've got is a kind of tax avoidance stroke tax evasion government here. I mean, we've also got Lord Green, for example, in the cabinet still, incredibly enough, who was in charge of HSBC all the time they were accepting money from the Mexican drug cartels, who have got literally hundreds of thousands of people around the world hooked on cocaine and heroin and all sorts of other drugs. And so you've got a kind of criminal cabinet, isn't that fair to say?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's probably a whole criminal parliament. David Gawke still refuses...
Not the whole parliament, surely.
Well, David Gawke still refuses to acknowledge the impact of the current laws introduced. But the fact is that this hasn't been brought up in Parliament on the grounds that the leadership of the Labour Party, they get a lot of lobbying and advice from PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is one of these major firms doing it.
Doing all the advice for lobbying. Yeah. Well, the good news is that last year's budget speech, Chancellor George Osborne described tax evasion and indeed aggressive tax avoidance as morally repugnant. And the David Cameron himself has been a harsh critic of companies that avoid paying their fair share of tax. And he suggested in 2012 that he would be willing to disclose information about his own financial affairs. Unfortunately, that's still not happened after over a year. Ian Cameron, David Cameron's father, who worked as a city stockbroker, first began setting up investment funds in 1979, shortly after Margaret Thatcher abolished capital controls. That's what you were talking about earlier, Jason, making it legal to take any sum of money out of the country without it being taxed. Ian Cameron became chairman of Close International Asset Management, based in Jersey, senior director of Blairmore Holdings. Blairmore? Gosh, nothing to do with Tony, I hope. registered in Panama, and a shareholder of Blairmore Asset Management, based in Geneva. They were both these companies, Blairmore, were named after the Camerons' ancestral home in Aberdeenshire, and were established in 1982 when the Prime Minister was a 16-year-old pupil at Eton.
I will say they did get a bit of resistance initially from HMRC.
That's Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs. Good.
Yes. That is, again, in tax... one of the reporters, when attending a conference in tax consultant persona, a partner from accounting firm Grant Thornton said that the structure was one that the revenue were finding particularly offensive. But when asked if he thought the scheme worked well, he said that he would still potentially give that option a yes. So a client adopting the scheme would therefore have to go into it knowing the revenue might take a different view. But this gives the lie to Nicholson, who is one of the leaders of Grant Thornton, I think, or HMRC.
Okay. Now,
terribly common structures. I'm actually going to cut across you there, Tony.
Okay.
It says later on, if you no longer fancy scheming around the law, the fact is that KPMG and Deloitte and PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Sorry, yeah.
Deloitte. They've pretty much had people in it from the start, so they've been... they've been using their knowledge and the advice they give to the government to actually get the law changed. So
they're called the big three, aren't they? These three.
Well, it's actually big. They're actually a big four.
Is it another one too?
It's got another one.
So we've got KPMG, who are very, very friendly with the Bristol City Council, of course, because they've got a free advisor to Mayor Ferguson, helping him do the budget for him. And also, they've just sold their headquarters by Temple Mead Station to the City Council. You've also got Deloitte's, PricewaterhouseCoopers, who have also got a Bristol connection because our Liberal Democrat MP for Bristol West, who is Stephen Williams, used to work for them as a corporate tax avoidance
There's a third one called EY, and this is led by former Treasury Special Advisor Chris Sanger.
So these are all the companies that have been helping avoid tax, and they're all very, very close to the government. The other thing that they were doing, Jason, I remember this story from a few months ago, was they all had their people in the Treasury helping the Treasury out. And of course, actually, what they were doing effectively is spying on the Treasury could find out.
Not only that, but over the last years, it says in quite a few points during this article, it says that they helped create the new system so that there would be holes. In fact, to take a look at the international view on this, one expert understands this is Pascal Saint-Amans. He's the head of tax at the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, who coordinate international efforts against tax dodging, told a US Congressional Committee in June that while many countries were moving towards a territorial tax system in the hope of blocking tax avoidance, the UK haven't. So while others have strengthened their offshore corporate legislation, the UK has lowered its corporate income tax and has also changed its offshore corporate legislation in a way that it's not about strengthening it. So as is put towards the end of the article, This makes the UK not just the world's sixth largest economy, but it is also the world's largest tax haven.
Right, and I wonder if Mr. Cameron's going to do anything about it. I doubt it, since his whole family fortune was built on tax avoidance. In a speech to business leaders in Maidenhead in 2012...
Oh, hello.
The Prime Minister... That's one of your haunts, isn't it?
That's my hometown.
The Prime Minister said... With the large companies that have the fancy corporate lawyers and the rest of it, I think we need a tougher approach. As said in Maidenhead, the great Maidenhead Declaration, one of the things that we are going to be looking at this year is whether there should be a general anti-avoidance power that Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs can use, particularly with the very wealthy individuals and with the bigger companies, to make sure they pay their fair share. Downing Street, however, refused to comment on the story of his father being one of the greatest tax avoiders in history, saying it concerned private matters of the Cameron family. Amazing, isn't it? So if you think anything's going to be done about this, I think we can just about forget it, because David Cameron has made his name as tax avoidance king of the world. Any more to this in this Panorama private eye investigation now, Jason?
Well, it's interesting because it's pointed out that one of the people who's been talking about this was somebody who's been working with the government, and that is David Heaton, who is a partner at Baker Tilly. Now, while he was working with the government, while he was advising the government, he also did a speech about how to keep the money out of the Chancellor's grubby mitts.
Oh, dear. So all these people are really a little bit too close. And if you didn't get that chap's name, it's Ian Cameron. Ian Cameron. He's the tax avoidance king of the globe. And it's David Cameron's dad. And most of the money
late
that Cameron's
Ian Cameron.
Got. Yes, the late Ian Cameron. And most of the money that the Cameron family have seems to have gone through this tax avoidance slush fund. Finally, Jason, have you got anything to say about Greece this week? Because we've had strikes, all sorts going on. I know you're half Greek. Have you been keeping an eye on what's happening over there?
Admittedly, I haven't actually, but it's an interesting situation.
I mean, we also had the murder, didn't we, of a rapper by the Golden Dawn. I mean,
yes,
they're talked about
sad,
as a Nazi party. I mean, why is it that Greece has got? I mean, I know back in the 1950s. There was actually a Nazi resurgence, wasn't there? It was a fascist government, basically.
Yes, I mean, that's actually part of the reason why I'm alive. My dad actually escaped it. He came to England and he met my mother while he was over here. So it's a real shame. Golden Dawn are the fourth biggest party in, or maybe they're fifth, biggest party in the Greek parliament. They are a far-right group. There is actually a stronger far left group, thankfully, Syriza, who are the actual opposition at the moment. But Golden Dawn, they're worryingly popular out there at the moment.
What? Why is it? Why is the people turning to these fascist groups?
Well, it's not just fascists. It's turning to groups on the far left, far right. But people are turning to these groups because they no longer have faith in the established parties.
Well, I just wonder how long it's going to take in Britain before it gets that way. Because,
well, I mean, it's heading that way with UKIP.
It certainly is.
I mean, I don't know if you saw the other day, but UKIP have barred their membership from joining Hope Not Hate, the leading anti-fascist party, either saying you're a member of Hope Not Hate or you're a member of UKIP.
I think they're just trying to make sure, aren't they, that they don't get too many extremists. Okay, anyway.
I do have one more thing to bring
on quickly.
In, actually. It's very quickly. The Labour Party this week have said that if elected, they will sack Atos, which is great.
Oh, well, yes, but I mean, you know, maybe too late for them to have made all this massive amount of public money on people's misery. Anyway, Jason, thanks very much. See you next week.
Thank you, Tony.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
What's on time? What's on time, Jeff?
Hello, this is What's On Guys from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 27th of September, Berry Tomorrow will be performing with support from Feed the Rhino, Empress and Heart in Hand at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. Into Saturday, 28th of September, the Lewis Creven Band will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts around 9pm. Into Song of the Week, and I present The Doors. This group formed in 1965 in Los Angeles, USA, and split up in 1973 after a career that included 9 studio albums, 3 of those released after Jim Morrison's death in 1971. This is from the second album they released, Strange Days, and is the song People Are Strange.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. No one remembers your name when you're strange. When you're strange, when you're strange. People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down. When you're strange, no one remembers your name. When you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange.
The Doors with People Are Strange from the album Strange Days. Keeping with 28th of September, Beggar Man's Beard will be performing with Alien Stashton and also one more band to be confirmed at the Brunswick and Park Road, Gloucester. Entry is free and the gig starts at 9 p.m. Finally, on Sunday 29th of September, Glory Hammer will be performing with support from Darkest Era, Dendera and Feversea at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Great choice, Jeff. Love the Doors. The first couple of albums in LA Woman take a lot of beating.
Oh, they were awesome albums.
That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast from your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks very much to Jill Bennett, our studio guest, talking about Desmond Morton, Winston Churchill's man of mystery, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, go through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733. As promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline 01454 318 753. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Calm before the storm. I know it's been cold. Yeah.